peered over the banister and saw a little girl of about 5 in a pale pink coat standing on the floor below me. Her hands pressed to her cheeks as the most horrific sound emerged from her mouth. I had never seen her before, and within a few seconds she turned on her heel and ran like an Olympic athlete down the stairs towards the first floor, down once again to the ground floor, along the hallway, and out onto the street beyond, slamming the heavy wooden door behind her so hard that the knocker rattled against the plate several times. I went back into my room and looked out the window, and there she was, charging into the heart of Dartmouth Square, at which point I lost sight of her. My heart was beating wildly in my chest, and I went back out to the landing, hoping for an explanation. But there was no one there, and the house had returned to silence. Disturbed now from my reading, I realized that I was thirsty, and made my way downstairs in search of something to drink, and to my surprise found another child, a boy of my own age, sitting in a chair in our hallway, a chair that existed for ornamental reasons and was not supposed to be used, turning the pages of a comic. "Hello," I said, and he glanced up at me and smiled. He had blonde hair and piercing blue eyes that captivated me immediately. Perhaps it was because I had been silent for more than a week that my words tumbled out of me like water overflowing a neglected bath. "My name's Sybil Avery, and I'm 7 years old. Charles and Maud are my parents, although they're not my real parents, they're my adoptive parents. I'm not sure who my real parents are, but I've lived here forever, and I have a room on the top floor. No one ever goes up there except the maid to clean it, so I have things just as I like them. What's your name, anyway?"
"Julian Woodbead," said Julian.
And a moment later I realized that I didn't feel shy around him at all, and that my stutter had gone. Julian. There is no denying the privilege in which Julian and I were brought up. Our families had money and status. They moved in elegant circles, with friends who held important positions in government or the arts. We lived in large houses where the menial work was undertaken by middle-aged women who arrived on early morning buses, making their way from room to room under the weight of dusters, mops, and brooms, and who were discouraged from speaking to us. Our housekeeper was named Brenda, and Maud insisted that she wear slippers around the house as the sound of Brenda's shoes on the wooden floors disturbed her writing. Her study was the only room in the house that the housekeeper was not permitted to clean, which accounted for the fact that there were always dust mites floating in the air alongside the cigarette smoke, creating a heavy atmosphere that was at its most overpowering in the late afternoon, when the sun poured through the windows as it continued its journey westward. While Brenda was a constant of my childhood, Julian's family employed a series of maids, none of whom lasted more than a year, and whether it was the difficulty of the work or the unkindness of the Woodbeads that drove them away, I never knew. But for all that we had, for all the luxury to which we were accustomed, we were both denied love, and this deficiency would be scorched into our future lives like an ill-considered tattoo inscribed on the buttocks after a drunken night out, leading each of us inevitably towards isolation and disaster. We attended different schools. I walked down to Ranelagh every morning, where I had a place at a small junior preparatory, while Julian was in a similar establishment a few miles north, on a quiet street close to St. Stephen's Green. Neither of us knew where we would be going after sixth class, but as Charles and Max had both been Belvedere College boys in their youth, this was where they had met, in fact, becoming friends as stalwarts of the rugby team that had lost to Castlelock College in the final of the 1931 Leinster Schools Cup. We assumed that there was a good chance that we would end up there too. Julian was not as unhappy in the education system as I was, but then he was much more of an extrovert by nature and found it easier to fit in with others. On the afternoon that we met, we exchanged only a few pleasantries in the hallway before I invited him upstairs, as children do, to see my room, and he followed me cheerfully and without question to the top of the house. As he stood beside my unmade bed, examining the books on my shelves and the toys that lay scattered on the floor, it occurred to me that he was the first child, other than myself, ever to set foot in there. "You're lucky to have so much space," he said.
balancing on the tips of his toes as he looked out the window into the square beyond. "And you have it all to yourself?"
"Yes," I said,
for my domain consisted of three rooms, a bedroom, a small bathroom, and a living area, which, I suppose, made it more of a self-contained apartment than anything else, not something that most seven-year-olds could lay claim to.
"Charles has the first floor, Maud has the second, and we all share the ground."
"You mean your parents don't sleep together?" he asked.
"Oh, no," I said.
"Why, do yours?"
"Of course they do."
"But why? Don't you have enough bedrooms?"
"We have four," he said. "My bedroom is next door to my sister's," he added, pulling a face.
"Was that the little girl who ran screaming from here earlier?" I asked.
"Yes."
"Why was she screaming? What upset her?"
"I haven't the foggiest," said Julian with a shrug. "She's always becoming hysterical over something. Girls are strange creatures, don't you think?"
"I don't know any," I admitted.
"I know lots. I love girls, even though they're crazy and mentally unbalanced, according to my father. Have you ever seen a pair of breasts?"
I stared at him in surprise. I was only 7 years old. Such thoughts had not yet occurred to me, but even then Julian's sexually precocious mind was already turning towards women.
"No," I said.
"I have," he told me proudly. "At a beach on the Algarve last summer. All the girls were going around topless. I got sunburned, I stayed out so long. Second-degree burns. I can't wait to have sex with a girl. Can you?"
I frowned. The word was a new one to me.
"What's sex?" I asked.
"You really don't know?" he asked.
"No," I said. And he took great delight in describing in detail actions that to me seemed not just unpleasant and unsanitary, but possibly criminal.
"Oh, that," I said, when he was finished,
pretending that I had known all along, for I didn't want him to look down on me and think me too innocent for his friendship.
"I thought you were talking about something else. I know all about that."
"Do you have any dirty magazines?"
he asked me then.
"No,"
I said, shaking my head.
"I have. I found one in my father's study. It was full of naked girls. It was an American magazine, of course, because naked girls are still illegal in Ireland."
"Are they?"
I asked, wondering how they bathed, if that was the case.
"Yes, the church doesn't let girls be naked until they're married. But the Americans do, and they take their clothes off all the time and let their pictures go into magazines, and then men go into shops and buy them with copies of History Today or Stamps Monthly, so they don't look like perverts."
"What's a pervert?"
I asked.
"It's someone who's a sex maniac,"
he explained.
"Oh."
"I'm going to be a pervert when I grow up," he continued.
"So am I,"
I said, eager to please.
"Perhaps we could be perverts together."
Even as the words came out of my mouth, I could tell there was something not quite right about them, and the expression on his face, one of disdain combined with mistrust, embarrassed me.
"I don't think so," he said quickly. "That's not how it works at all. Boys can only be perverts with girls."
"Oh,"
I said, disappointed.
"Do you have a big thing?"
he asked a few moments later, after picking up all the keepsakes on my desk, examining them and putting them back down again in the wrong places.
"Do I what?"
I asked.
"A big thing,"
he repeated.
"You need a big thing if you want to be a pervert. Shall we see whose is the biggest?
I bet mine is." My mouth dropped open in surprise, and I felt a curious stirring at the pit of my stomach, an entirely new sensation that I couldn't quite understand, but that I felt happy to encourage.
"All right,"
I said.
"You first,"
said Julian.
"Why me first?"
"Because I said so, that's why."
I hesitated, but not wanting him to change his mind and move on to a different game, I undid my belt buckle and pulled my trousers and underwear down to my knees, and he leaned forward, an interested expression on his face as he stared at it.
"I think that's what they call average," he said after a moment, "although even that might be generous of me."
"I'm only 7,
I said, feeling offended as I pulled my pants back up.
"I'm only 7 too, but I'm bigger,"
he said, pulling his trousers down now in order to show me, and this time I could feel the room spin a little as I stared at it. I knew there was danger to this, that to be caught would be to invite trouble and disgrace, but the risk excited me. His was definitely bigger, and it fascinated me, for it was the first penis outside of my own that I had ever seen, and as he was circumcised and I was not, it intrigued me.
"Where's the rest of us?"
I asked.
"What do you mean?"
he said, pulling his pants up and refastening his belt without an ounce of self-consciousness.
"The rest of your thing,"
I said. "They cut it off," he said, "when I was a baby." I felt a stab of pain run through me.
"Why did they do that?" I asked.
"I'm not sure," he said. "It happens to lots of boys when they're young. It's a Jewish thing."
"Are you Jewish?"
"No, why?" "Are you?"
"No."
"Well, then." "It won't happen to me," I said, horrified by the notion of anyone coming at my nether regions with a knife.
"It might.
Anyway, have you ever been to France?"
"To France?"
I asked, uncertain why he was asking.
"No, why?"
"We're going there in our summer holidays this year, that's all."
"Oh,"
I said, disappointed that we had moved away from talking about sex, perverts, and things, as I would have liked to continue discussing them for a little while longer, but he seemed to have grown bored of them now. I wondered if I brought the conversation back to girls, whether he might indulge me a little longer.
"Do you just have one sister?" I asked.
"Yes," he said.
"Alice. She's 5. "Any brothers?"
He shook his head. "No."
"You?" "I'm an only child."
At that age, of course, it didn't even occur to me that my birth mother might have gone on to have more children, or that my natural father had most likely sired a brood of them before or since my conception.
"Why do you call your parents Charles and Maud?"
he asked.
"They prefer it that way,"
I said.
"I'm adopted, you see, and it's to show that I'm not a real Avery."
He laughed and shook his head and said something that made me laugh.
"Bizarro."
A tap on the door disturbed us, and I turned around cautiously, like a character in a scary film that thinks there's a murderer waiting outside. No one ever visited the top floor except Brenda, and even she only dared to enter when I was at school.
"What's the matter?"
asked Julian.
"Nothing."
"You look nervous."
"I'm not nervous."
"I said you look nervous."
"It's just that no one ever comes up here," I said.
I watched as the door handle slowly turned, then took a step back, and Julian, infected by my anxiety, moved towards the window. A moment later, a cloud of smoke entered the room, followed inevitably by Maud. I hadn't seen her in days, and was surprised that her hair was not quite as blonde as usual, and she was looking painfully thin. Her recent illness had left her with a weak appetite, and she rarely ate any more.
"I can't keep anything down," she told me on the last occasion that we had spoken. "Anything except nicotine, that is."
"Maud," I said, surprised to see her there.
"Cyril,"
she replied, glancing around, surprised to see another boy in my room.
"There you are." "But who is this?"
"Julian Woodbead,"
said Julian in a confident tone.
"My father is Max Woodbead, the famous solicitor."
He extended a hand, and she stared at it for a moment, as if baffled by its appearance.
"What do you want?"
she asked.
"Money?" "No,"
said Julian, starting to laugh.
"My father says it's good manners to shake hands upon making a new acquaintance."
"Oh, I see," she said, leaning over and examining his fingers.
"Is it clean? Have you been to the bathroom lately? Did you wash your hands afterwards?"
"It's perfectly clean, Mrs. Avery," said Julian.
She sighed, reached out her own hand, and shook his for about a tenth of a second.
"You have very soft skin," she said, purring a little. "Little boys generally do, of course. They're not used to hard work. How old are you, if you don't mind my asking?"
"I'm 7,
said Julian.
"No, Cyril is 7,
she replied, shaking her head.
"I was asking how old you are."
"Well, I'm 7 too," he said. "We both are."
"Both 7,
she said almost in a whisper. "Isn't that a bit of a coincidence?" "I don't think it is, really," he said, considering it. "Everyone in my class at school is 7, and everyone in Cyril's too, I imagine. There's probably the same number of 7-year-olds in Dublin as there are people of any age." "Perhaps," replied Maud, unconvinced. "Might I ask what you're doing in Cyril's bedroom? Did he know that you were coming? You're not being unpleasant to him, are you? He does seem to attract bullies." "Julian was sitting in the hallway," I told her, "on the ornamental chair that isn't supposed to be used."
"Oh, no," said Maud, appalled. "That was my mother's."
"I didn't damage it," said Julian.
"My mother was Evelyn Hartford," said Maud,
as if this would mean something to one or the other of us.
"So, as you know, she simply adored chairs."
"They are terribly useful," replied Julian, catching my eye and winking at me. "If one wants to sit down, I mean."
"Well, yes," said Maud in a distant tone. "I mean, that's what they're for, isn't it?"
"But not the ornamental chair," I pointed out. "You told me never to sit on that one."
"That's because you have a habit of collecting dirt," she said. "Julian, on the other hand, looks rather clean. Did you have a bath this morning?"
"I did, actually," said Julian. "But then I have a bath most mornings."
"Good for you. I find it almost impossible to persuade Cyril to wash."
"That's not true," I said, insulted, in part because I was meticulous about my personal hygiene, but also because even at that age I hated when people attributed characteristics to me that had no basis in truth.
"I would, however, ask you not to sit in it again, if you don't mind," continued Maud, ignoring my interruption.
"You have my word, Mrs. Avery," said Julian,
performing a little bow at the waist that made her smile. An event almost as rare as a solar eclipse.
"You write novels, don't you?" he asked then.
"That's right," she said.
"How did you know that?"
"My father told me. He said he hasn't read any himself because you mostly write about women."
"I do," she admitted.
"Might I ask why?" "Because the male writers never do. They don't have the talent, you see, or the wisdom."
"Julian's father is here to see Charles," I said, keen to turn the conversation away from chairs and books. "When I discovered him downstairs, I thought he might like to come up to see my room."
"And did you?" asked Maud, sounding astonished by the concept. "Did you want to see Cyril's room?"
"Yes, very much so. He has a lot of space up here, doesn't he? I envy him that. And that skylight is wonderful. Imagine being able to lie in bed at night and look up at the stars."
"Someone died up here once, you know," said Maud, sniffing the air, which was already filled with carcinogens from her cigarettes, as if hoping for the last olfactory vestiges of death.
"What?"
I asked, appalled.
"Who?"
This was the first time I had heard of this.
"Oh, I can't remember. Some man, I think. Or possibly a woman. A person, shall we say. It was all such a long time ago."
"Was it natural causes, Mrs. Avery?" asked Julian.
"No, I don't think so. If memory serves, he, she, or it was murdered. I'm not sure if the killer was ever caught. It was in all the papers at the time."
She waved her hand in the air, and some ash fell on my head.
"I can't remember the details very well," she said. "Was there a knife involved? For some reason, I have the word knife in my head."
"A stabbing?"
said Julian, rubbing his hands together in glee.
"Do you mind if I sit down, Cyril?"
asked Maud, pointing at the bed. "If you must."
She sat and smoothed down her skirt, fishing another cigarette from her silver case. Her fingers were long and bony, the skin almost translucent. I would have only needed to look a little closer to make out the joints between the phalanges.
"Do you have a light?"
she asked me, holding a fresh cigarette in my direction.
"No, of course not," I said.
"I bet you do," she said, turning to Julian and allowing her tongue to move slowly across her upper lip.
Had I been a little older, I would have realized that she was flirting with him, and he was flirting right back.
Which, of course, is a little disturbing in retrospect, considering the fact that he was just a child, and she was 34 by then.
"I might have some matches," he replied,
turning out the contents of his pockets onto my bedspread. A piece of string, a yo-yo, a florin, the ace of spades, and, indeed, a match.
"I knew it," he said, smiling at her. "Aren't you a useful little thing?" she replied. "I should lock you up and never let you go."
Julian struck the match off the sole of his shoe, and when it lit first time, I found it hard to conceal my admiration. He held it out to Maud, who leaned forward, keeping her eyes locked on his as the cigarette began to spark, and then she sat back again, her left hand poised on the mattress behind her. She continued to stare at him before turning her face towards the ceiling and blowing a great cloud of white smoke in the air, as if she was preparing to announce the election of a new pope.
"I was writing, you see,"
she declared after a moment, apropos of nothing.
"I was writing my new novel, and I could hear voices up here. It was simply too distracting. My train of thought derailed. And so I thought I would come up to see what all the fuss was about."
I raised an eyebrow skeptically. It seemed unlikely to me that Maud had heard us talking from the floor below, particularly when we had scarcely been making any noise at all. But perhaps her hearing was more finely attuned than I realized, despite her now resolved cancer of the ear canal.
"Do you enjoy being a writer, Mrs. Avery?" asked Julian.
"No, of course not," she said. "It's a hideous profession, entered into by narcissists who think their pathetic little imaginations will be of interest to people they've never met."
"But are you successful?"
"Depends on how you define the word success."
"Well, do you have a lot of readers?"
"Oh, no, heaven forfend. There's something terribly crude about a popular book, don't you think?"
"I don't know," said Julian. "I'm afraid I don't read very much."
"Neither do I," said Maud. "I can't remember the last time I read a novel. They're all so tedious, and writers do go on at such length. Brevity is the key, if you ask me. What was the last book you read?"
"Five Have a Wonderful Time," said Julian.
"Who wrote that?"
"Enid Blyton."
She shook her head as if the name meant nothing to her.
"Why don't you want people to read your books, Maud?"
I asked, a question that I had never put to her before.
"For the same reason that I don't walk into strangers' houses and tell them how many bowel movements I've enjoyed since breakfast," she said.
"It's none of their business."
"Then why do you publish them?"
"One has to do something with them, Cyril, doesn't one?" she said with a shrug. "Otherwise, what's the point of writing them at all?"
I frowned.
This didn't make sense to me, but I didn't want to pursue the subject. I wanted her to go back downstairs and leave Julie and me to our incipient friendship. Perhaps he'd ask to see my thing again and take his out for a second viewing.
"Your father is here to save the day, isn't he?"
asked Maud, turning to Julian again and patting the space on the bed beside her. "I'm not sure," said Julian, taking the hint and sitting down.
I was surprised and annoyed to see him staring at her legs. "Everyone has legs," I thought. "What was so special about Maud's?"
"Does it need saving?"
"The man from the revenue is after us," she replied,
her tone suggesting that she was confiding in one of her closest friends.
"My husband, Cyril's adoptive father, has not always been as diligent with his finances as he might have been, and it seems that his misdemeanors have finally caught up with him. I keep a separate accountant myself, of course, to look after the tax issues with my books. Fortunately, as I sell so few, I don't have to pay anything. It's a blessing in some ways,
As it happens, I give my accountant more than I give the man from the revenue. Has he been to your house at all?
Who?
Asked Julian. The man from the revenue.
What do you suppose he looks like?
He frowned, uncertain what she meant.
I thought about it, too, and despite my youth, I felt sure that there were many men employed by the Department of Finance, and possibly even the occasional woman.
Wouldn't there be a group of them?
I asked.
Each of whom looks after different cases?
Oh, no, said Maud, shaking her head.
No, as far as I know, there's only one. Busy fellow, I imagine.
Anyway, the point is your father is here to keep my husband out of jail, isn't he?
I'm not saying a spell inside wouldn't do Charles the world of good, but I'd be obliged to visit, for form's sake, if nothing else, and I don't think I could do that.
I imagine they're rather unpleasant places, prisons,
and I don't think you can smoke in there.
I think you can, I said. Don't prisoners use cigarettes as currency?
And to fend off potential attacks by homosexuals, said Julian.
Well, quite, agreed Maud, who didn't seem the least shocked by Julian's choice of words.
But I don't think Charles need worry too much about that, do you? His best days are behind him.
Homosexuals in prison aren't picky, Mrs. Avery, said Julian. They'll take whatever they can get.
No, but they're not blind, either.
What's a homosexual?
I asked.
A man who's afraid of women, said Maud.
Every man is afraid of women, as far as I can see, said Julian, displaying an understanding of the universe far beyond his years.
That's true, she said.
But only because most men are not as smart as women, and yet they continue to hold all the power. They fear a change of the world order.
Is Charles going to jail?
I asked. And even though I had no great affection for the man, the idea made me uneasy.
That's up to Julian's father, said Maud, and how good he is at his job.
I don't know much about my father and your husband's business, said Julian. He only brought me with him today because I set fire to a curtain last week, and I'm not allowed to be in the house of my own any more.
Why did you do that?
It was an accident.
Oh.
She seemed satisfied by this response and stood up now, pressing the cigarette out on my bedside table, leaving a scorch mark in the wood that would never disappear. Glancing around, she seemed astonished by the very existence of the room, and I wondered where she thought I'd been sleeping for the past 7 years.
"So this is where you hide away, Cyril, is it?"
she asked dreamily.
"I often wondered."
She turned and pointed at the bed.
"And I suppose this is where you sleep."
"It is," I admitted.
"Unless it's ornamental," said Julian. "Like your mother's chair." Maud smiled at both of us and made her way towards the door.
"Do try to keep it down, boys, if you can. I intend to return to my writing now. I believe the train is reapproaching the station. I might get a few hundred words down if I'm lucky."
And with that, to my great relief, she left us alone.
"What a peculiar lady," remarked Julian,
taking his shoes and socks off now and, for no explicable reason, jumping up and down on my bed. I looked at his feet and noticed how neatly trimmed his toenails were.
"My mother's nothing like yours."
"She's my adoptive mother,"
I pointed out.
"Oh, yes.
Did you ever meet your real mother?"
"No."
"Do you think your adoptive mother is secretly your real mother?"
"No,"
I said.
"What sense would that make?"
"How about your adoptive father, then?"
"No,"
I replied. "Definitely not." He reached over and took Maud's discarded cigarette from the table and drew noisily on the filter, pulling a face as he held it dangerously close to the curtain. Now I knew he had form when it came to burning draperies. I watched him warily.
"Do you think your father is going to jail?"
he asked me.
"My adoptive father," I said, "and I don't know. I suppose he might do. I don't know much about what's going on, except that he's in a spot of bother. That's how he refers to it, anyway."
"I was in jail once," said Julian casually.
falling down on the bed now and stretching out as if he owned the place. His shirt had come loose from his trousers, revealing his navel and stomach, and I stared at them, rather fascinated by his pale skin.
"You are not," I said.
"I was," he said. "I swear."
"When? What did you do?"
"Not as a prisoner, of course."
"Oh," I said, laughing. "I thought that's what you meant."
"No, that would be ridiculous. I went with my father. He was representing a man who murdered his wife, and he brought me with him to the joy."
My eyes opened wide now in fascination. I had a peculiar obsession at that age with murder stories, and a visit to the joy, the colloquial term for Mountjoy Prison, was a common threat that teachers used to admonish us.
Our every misdeed, from forgetting our homework to yawning in class, resulted in the promise that we were likely to end our days there at the end of a hangman's noose, despite the fact that capital punishment wasn't actually legal in Ireland anymore.
"What was it like?" I asked.
"It smelled of toilets," he said, grinning, and I giggled in appreciation. "And I had to sit in the corner of a cell when they brought the man in, and my father started asking him questions and making notes and saying that he needed to clarify a few things, so he could explain them to the man's barrister. And the man asked, 'Does it matter that my wife was a dirty slut who put it about with every Tom, Dick and Harry in Ballyfermot?' And my father told him that they would be doing everything they could to impugn the victim's character, as there was a good chance that a jury would forgive a man a murder if the victim was a whore." I gasped. I'd never heard such words spoken aloud before, and they filled me with horror and excitement. I could have sat there all afternoon listening to Julian. So great an impression was he making on me, and would have asked many more questions about his experience at the prison, only at that moment the door opened again, and a tall man with ludicrously bushy eyebrows poked his head inside.
"We're going," said the man,
and Julian jumped up immediately.
"Why are you not wearing your shoes or socks?"
"I was trampolining on Cyril's bed."
"Who's Cyril?"
"I'm Cyril," I said,
and the man looked me up and down, as if I was a piece of furniture he was considering acquiring.
"Oh, you're the charity case," he said, sounding uninterested.
I didn't have any answer to this, and by the time I thought of something clever to say, they had both left the room and were making their way downstairs.
A great love affair. The question of how Charles and Maud met, fell in love and got married, was one that fascinated me throughout my childhood. Two people who could not have been more ill-suited to each other's company had somehow managed to find each other and sustain something resembling a relationship while apparently feeling no interest or affection for the other whatsoever.
Had it always been that way, I wondered? Had there ever been a time when they looked at each other and felt desire, respect, or love? Was there a moment when they realized that this was the person they wanted to be with over all others? And, if not, why on earth had they committed to a shared life? It was a question that I asked each of them at different times during our acquaintance, and the answers I received could not have been more different. Charles.
I was 26 years old when I met Maud, and there wasn't any part of me that was looking for either a girlfriend or a wife. I'd been down the road before, and the whole thing had proved insufferable. You probably don't know this, Cyril, but I was married when I was only 22 and widowed a couple of years later. Oh, you did know. Well, there are all sorts of rumours going around about how Emily died, but let me make one thing very clear. I did not murder her. But no charges were ever brought to suggest that I did, despite the best efforts of a certain Sergeant Henry O'Flynn of Pierce Street Garda Station. There was never a shred of evidence to suggest anything untoward took place, but the engines that power Dublin are lubricated by exactly this kind of irresponsible tittle-tattle, and a man's reputation can be destroyed overnight if you're not willing to fight back. The truth is, Emily was a lovely girl, very personable, if you like that sort of thing, but she was also my first girlfriend, the girl to whom I lost my virginity, and no man with any sense should marry the girl to whom he loses his virginity. It's like learning to drive in some clapped-out old banger and then holding on to it for the rest of your life when you've developed the skill to handle a BMW in rush-hour traffic on a busy autobahn. A few months after the wedding, I realized that I couldn't possibly be satisfied with one woman for the rest of my life. I started to cast my nets a little wider. Look at me, Cyril. I'm a ridiculously good-looking man now, so you can only imagine what I looked like in my 20s. Women fell over themselves to get me, and I was generous enough to let them approach. But Emily caught wind of my extramarital shenanigans and completely overreacted, threatening to call the parish priest in, as if that was something that would concern me. And I said, "Darling, take a lover, if you want. It makes no difference to me. If you need cock, there's plenty of it out there. Big ones, small ones, perfectly formed ones, misshapen ones, bent ones, curved ones, straight ones. Young men are basically walking erections, and any one of them would be happy to stick it in someone as beautiful as you. Try a teenager, if you like. They'd be only too delighted. And, you know, they could go 5 or 6 times a night without even stopping to take a breath." I meant this as a compliment, but for whatever reason, that's not how she took it, and she fell into a spiral of recrimination and depression. Maybe she'd always suffered some sort of psychological affliction. So many women do. But within months, she was taking medication to stop her going completely doolally. And then one day she swallowed a few too many pills just before she took a bath, and down she went under the water, bubble, bubble. Good night and good luck to all. And, yes, it's true that I inherited a lot of money from her, which is why all that gossip began in the first place, but I assure you that I had nothing to do with what happened that day, and her death saddened me a great deal. I didn't have sex for almost 2 weeks afterwards, out of respect for her memory. You see, here's the thing, Cyril, and if I'd had a real son, I would have ensured that he understood this. Monogamy is simply not the natural state for a man. And when I say man, I mean man or woman. It just doesn't make sense to manacle yourself sexually to the same person for 50 or 60 years when your relationship with that person can be so much happier if you give each other the freedom to enter and be entered by people of the opposite sex whom you find attractive. A marriage should be about friendship and companionship, not about sex. I mean, what man in his right mind wants to have sex with his own wife? However, despite all that, when I laid eyes on your adoptive mother for the first time, I knew immediately that I wanted her to be the second Mrs. Avery. She was standing in the lingerie section of Switzer's department store when I saw her, running her hand along a railing of bras and panties, a cigarette hanging perilously close to the silk. And I walked up to her and asked her whether she needed any help choosing the right pair. My God, that woman had perfect tits. She still does. Have you ever taken a good look at your adoptive mother's tits, Cyril? No? Don't look so embarrassed. It's the most natural thing in the world. We suckle them as babies and long to suckle them as adults. She slapped my face when I said that, but that slap remains one of the most erotic moments of my life. I grabbed her hand and kissed the underside of her wrist. It smelled of Chanel No. 5 and Mary Rose sauce. I suppose she'd just come from lunch, and as you know, she's always been partial to a prawn cocktail. I told her that if she didn't come to the Gresham Hotel with me that afternoon for a glass of champagne, I would throw myself into the Liffey, and she said, "Drown for all I care," and that she had no intention of spending a Wednesday afternoon getting drunk in a hotel bar with a strange man. And yet, somehow, I talked her around, and we ended up taking a taxi to O'Connell Street, and drinking not one but 6 bottles of champagne over the course of not one but 6 hours. Can you believe it? We were practically paralytic by the time we were finished. But not so paralytic that we couldn't take a room in the hotel and make love for 48 hours with scarcely a break. My God, that woman did things to me that no woman before or since has ever done. Until you've been fellated by your adoptive mother, Cyril, you will not know what a quality blowjob really is. We were married within months. But once again, time took its toll. Maud became more obsessed with her writing, and I with my career. I grew bored of her body, and I dare say she grew bored of mine. But whereas I sought comfort elsewhere, it seemed that she had no interest in taking a lover, and because of that she's remained celibate for years now, which probably accounts for her moods. It's true, we're not the ideal couple, but I loved her once, and she loved me, and somewhere inside us both lingers the shadow of 20-something sexual beings drinking Veuve Clicquot in the Gresham, laughing our backsides off and wondering whether we could ask the receptionist for a bedroom key, or whether the police or the Archbishop of Dublin might be called if we did.
Maud. I really can't remember. It might have been a Wednesday, if that's any use to you, or possibly a Thursday.
When my enemies pursue me. The relationship between my adoptive parents simply wasn't engaged enough for them to generate the kind of passion required for an argument, which meant that Dartmouth Square was for the most part a harmonious place to live. In fact, the only serious fight I ever witnessed between them took place on the night the jurors came to dinner, a plan so ill-advised in its conception that it baffles me to this day. It was one of those rare evenings when Charles returned home early from work. I had just left the kitchen with a glass of milk in my hand, and was astonished to see him walking through the door, his tie not loosened around his neck, his hair not dishevelled upon his head, his gait not unsteady, a series of knots that suggested something terrible had taken place.
"Charles," I said, "are you all right?"
"Yes, I'm fine," he replied. "Why shouldn't I be?"
I glanced at the grandfather clock in the corner of the hallway, and, as if it was in cahoots with me, it struck 6 o'clock with half a dozen long and echoing chimes. As we waited for it to finish, Charles and I stayed exactly where we were, not saying a word, although we smiled awkwardly and acknowledged each other's presence with the occasional nod of the head. Finally, the ringing came to an end. "It's just that you never come home at this hour," I said, picking up where I'd left off. "You realize that it's still daylight out and the pubs are still open?"
"Don't be cheeky," he said.
"I'm not being cheeky," I told him. "I'm concerned, that's all."
"Oh, in that case,
thank you. Your concern is noted. You know, it's remarkable how much easier it is to unlock the door when it's bright outside," he added. "Usually I'm stuck on the porch for a few minutes at least before I can get in. I always thought it was a problem with the key, but perhaps it was me all along."
"Charles," I said, putting my glass down on an occasional table and walking towards him, "you're completely sober, aren't you?"
"Yes, Cyril," he replied. "I haven't had a drink all day."
"But why? Are you ill?"
"I have been known to get through the day without lubrication, you know. I'm not a complete alcoholic."
"Not a complete one, no," I said. "But you are quite good at it."
He smiled, and for a moment I thought I saw something approaching tenderness in his eyes.
"It's kind of you to care," he said. "But I'm perfectly fine."
I wasn't so sure.
In recent weeks his usual exuberance had diminished noticeably, and I often passed his study to find him seated behind his desk with a far-away expression on his face, as if he couldn't quite understand how things had got this far. He had bought a copy of One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich in Hodges Figures, and could be found engrossed in it at every spare moment, showing more interest in Solzhenitsyn's novel than he ever had in any of Maud's, even Like to the Lark, which he had practically disowned when sales figures soared towards triple figures. That he was comparing his own trials to that of a prisoner in a Soviet labor camp says something of his sense of personal injustice. Of course, he'd never expected his case to go all the way to trial.
assuming that a man in his position and with his wide network of influential contacts would be able to prevent such an injustice taking place. And even when it became clear that there was nothing he could do to stop the trial going ahead, he was certain that he would be found innocent of any wrongdoing, despite his obvious guilt. Prison, he believed, was something that happened to other people. Max Woodbead was a regular visitor to Dartmouth Square during those weeks, and Charles and he would veer from drunken caterwauling to the singing of old Belvedere College songs. Only in God is found safety when my enemies pursue me. Only in God is found glory when I am found meek and lowly. To roaring at each other in furious rages. Storms that echoed around the house and caused even Maud to open the door of her study and stare out in bewilderment as she escaped the festering twilight of her writing room.
"Is that you, Brenda?"
she asked me on one of those occasions when, for some forgotten reason, I was found loitering around the second floor.
"No, it's me, Cyril," I said. "Oh, Cyril, yes," she said. "Of course, the child. What on earth is going on downstairs? Has there been a break-in?" "Mr. Woodbead is here," I said. "He came over to discuss the case with Charles. I think they might be raiding the drinks cabinet."
"It's no good, of course. He's going to jail. Everyone knows it.
All the whiskey in the world won't change that." "And what will become of us?" I asked anxiously.
I was only 7 years old. I wasn't prepared for a life on the streets.
"I'll be all right," she said. "I have a little money of my own." "But what about me?" I asked. "Why must they be so loud?" she asked, ignoring my question. "Really, it's too much. How is a person supposed to get any work done? By the way, since you're here, can you think of another word for fluorescent?" she asked.
"Glowing?" I suggested.
"Luminous? Incandescent?"
"Incandescent, that's the one," she said. "You're a clever boy for 11, aren't you?"
"I'm 7,
I told her, struck once again by the question of whether my adoptive parents even realized that I was a child, and not some sort of small adult who had been foisted upon them.
"Well then, even more impressive," she said,
closing the door behind her and returning to her smoke-filled cave. The case were the two words that echoed around our home throughout most of 1952. They were never far from any of our minds and always on the tip of Charles's tongue.
He seemed to be genuinely insulted that he was being made to suffer such public indignity, and hated seeing his name in the papers for any reason other than a celebratory one. Indeed, when the Evening Press published an article stating that his wealth had been much exaggerated over the years, and that should he lose and face not only a period of imprisonment but a hefty pecuniary punishment, he would most likely go bankrupt and be forced to sell the house on Dartmouth Square, he spiraled into a blustering hurricane of rage, like King Lear in the Badlands, calling forth to the winds and the cataracts and the all-shaking thunder to drench the steeples, drown the cocks and singe his fine head of dark hair, until the thick rotundity of the world had been struck flat. Max, instructed to issue legal proceedings against the newspaper, wisely ignored the directive. The dinner party was arranged for a Thursday night, 4 evenings into a trial that was expected to last 2 weeks. Max had selected a single juror whom he believed to be particularly susceptible to influence, and run into him accidentally on purpose as he walked along Aston Quay one night, inviting him into a pub for a drink. While there, Max informed the man, one Dennis Wilbert of Dorset Street, who taught mathematics, Latin, and geography at a school near Clanbrassil Street, that the close relationship he had formed with 12-year-old Connor Llewellyn, his star pupil who received top marks in every examination despite the emptiness of his deeply attractive head, was one that could be misconstrued by both the newspapers and the Gardaí alike, and that if he didn't want this information to appear in the public domain, he might want to give serious thought to his verdict in Department of Finance versus Avery.
"And of course," he added, "anything you can do to persuade the other jurors would be most welcome, too."
With one in his pocket, he hired his favourite disgraced Garda to gather dirt on the rest of the panel. To his disappointment, former Superintendent Lavery came back with precious little. Three had secrets, he was told. One man had been accused of exposing himself to a girl on the Milltown Road, but the charges had been dismissed as the girl had been a Protestant. One had a subscription with an agency in Paris who sent him a selection of postcards every month featuring naked women wearing jodhpurs. And a third, one of only two female jurors, had given birth to a child outside of marriage and failed to inform her employers, who would undoubtedly have sacked her as they were the supposed guardians of public morality, the Parliament of Ireland, Dáil Éireann. Rather than track each person down and make veiled threats to expose their secrets, Max did something far more gentlemanly. He invited them to dinner. Using Mr. Wilbert, the paedophile teacher, as his middleman, he made it clear that should they refuse the invitation, the information that he had gathered on them would be leaked to the papers. What he didn't mention, of course, was that he would neither be the host of the dinner nor a guest around the table. Instead, that honour would fall to the man in the dock, my adoptive father, Charles Avery. Charles invited me and Maud into his study that evening, shortly before the guests arrived, and we settled into the wing-backed armchairs that stood opposite his desk while he laid out his plans for the night ahead. "The most important thing," he told us, "is that we put on a united front. We need to give the impression that we are a happy, loving family." "We are a happy, loving family," said Maud, sounding offended by any suggestion to the contrary.
"That's the spirit," said Charles. "As much as it won't be in any of their interests to bring in a guilty verdict, we need to soothe their consciences by making them believe that tearing the three of us apart would be a reprehensible act akin to introducing divorce in Ireland."
"Who are they, anyway?" asked Maud,
lighting a fresh cigarette as the one she was smoking was coming perilously close to the end.
"Are they our sort of people?"
"I'm afraid not," replied Charles. "Teacher, a dock worker, a bus driver, and a woman who works in the tea room at Dáil Éireann."
"Good Lord," she said. "They let anyone on the juries these days, don't they?"
"I think that's always been the case, my love. But was it really necessary to invite them into our home?" she asked. "Could we not have simply taken them out for a meal in town? There are a number of restaurants that people of that type would never get the chance to enjoy."
"Darling," replied Charles, smiling, "oh, sweet-natured wife of mine, remember this dinner is a secret. If it were to get out, well, there would naturally be a lot of trouble over it. No one must know."
"Of course, but they sound so mundane," said Maud,
rubbing her arm as if a cold wind had just entered the room.
"Will they have washed?"
"They seem clean in court," said Charles.
"Actually, they make a real effort, best suits and so on, as if they're going to mass."
Maud opened her mouth in horror.
"Are they papists?" she asked.
"I've no idea," said Charles in exasperation. "Does it matter?"
"As long as they don't want to pray before we eat," she muttered,
looking around the study, a room in the house that she almost never entered.
"Oh, look," she said,
pointing at a copy of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations that was lying on a side table.
"I have the same edition upstairs. How funny."
"Now, Cyril," said my adoptive father, turning to me, "strict house rules are in play tonight, understand? Only speak when you're spoken to. Don't make jokes. Don't break wind. Look at me with as much adoration in your eyes as you can possibly muster. I left a list of things that we do as father and son on your bed. Did you memorize it?"
"I did,"
I said. "Repeat them back to me."
"We fish the Great Lakes of Connemara together. We attend GAA matches in Croke Park. We have an ongoing game of chess, for we only make one move per day. We braid each other's hair."
"I told you, no jokes."
"Sorry."
"And don't call us Charles and Maud, all right? Tonight you must address us as father and mother. It will sound peculiar to our guests if you say anything else."
I frowned. I wasn't sure I could bring myself to say those words any more than a different child might be able to bring themselves to call their parents by their Christian names.
"I'll try my best, father," I said. "You don't need to start now," instructed Charles. "Wait until the guests have arrived."
"Yes, Charles," I said.
"We're not a real Avery, after all."
"What exactly is the point of all this, anyway?" asked Maud. "Why must we debase ourselves with these people?"
"So that I can stay out of prison, sweet one," replied Charles cheerfully. "We must flatter and cajole, and if all else fails, I will take them in here one by one later in the evening and write them each a check. Either way, I intend to end this evening confident in a verdict of not guilty."
"Will Mr. Woodbeat be coming to dinner?" I asked, and Charles shook his head.
"No," he said. "It all goes tits up. He can't afford to be seen to have anything to do with this."
"Charles, your language, please," said Maud with a sigh. "So Julian won't be coming either?" I asked.
"Who's Julian?"
asked Charles. "Mr. Woodbeat's son."
"Why on earth would he?"
I looked down at the carpet and felt my heart sink. I had only seen Julian on one other occasion since his initial visit, and that was almost a month before, when we had got on even better than we had the first time, although, to my great disappointment, an opportunity had not presented itself for either of us to pull our pants down and expose ourselves to each other. I had been intoxicated by the notion of a friendship with him, and the fact that he seemed to enjoy my company, too, was such a startling concept that it had started to dominate my thoughts. But, of course, we were not schooled together, and therefore we were unlikely to meet again unless Max brought him to Dartmouth Square. It was a source of the deepest frustration to me.
"I just thought he might," I said.
"Sorry to disappoint you," said Charles. "I had thought about inviting a bunch of 7-year-olds to dinner, but then I remembered that tonight was really rather important, and our future happiness might depend on the outcome."
"So he's not coming," I said, just to clarify.
"No," said Charles, "he's not."
"So Elizabeth won't be coming either?" asked Maud.
"Elizabeth?"
asked Charles, sitting upright as if startled, his face flushing a little.
"Max's wife."
"I didn't know that you knew Elizabeth."
"I don't. Not very well, anyway. But we've met at a couple of charity events. She's rather lovely in an obvious sort of way."
"No, Elizabeth won't be coming,"
said Charles, looking down at the desk again and drumming his fingers on his ink blotter.
"Just the working-class people," said Maud.
"Yes, just them."
"What fun."
"It's only for a few hours, my darling. I'm sure you can get through it."
"Will they understand which knives and forks to use?" she asked.
"Oh, for pity's sake," said Charles, shaking his head. "They're not animals. What do you think they're going to do? Stab the beef with a toothpick, hold it in the air, and start chewing around the sides?"
"Are we having beef?" she asked. "I was rather in the mood for fish tonight."
"There's a fish starter," said Charles.
"Scallops," I said. "I saw them in the kitchen." "I'm not being a snob," insisted Maud. "I only ask because if these people are unaccustomed to fine dining, they might feel intimidated by the prospect. Faced with competing sets of cutlery, they might think that we're mocking them and react to their humiliation by despising you even more. You forget that I'm a novelist, Charles. I have a keen understanding of human nature."
My adoptive father's tongue bulged in his cheek as he considered this. She had a point.
"Well, what do you suggest I do?" he asked eventually.
"It's a 5-course meal. There's a dozen pieces of cutlery at each table setting. I can hardly stick labels on each one saying, 'This is the fish knife, this is the bread knife, this is the pudding fork,' can I?"
"No,"
said Maud. "And it would be impossible to find labels that small, anyway, particularly at such short notice. We'd need to order them in."
Charles stared at her, and seemed on the verge of laughing, which would surely have shocked both of us, as it was a sound with which we were entirely unfamiliar.
"Is there anything else we need to know?"
asked Maud, glancing at her watch. "Or can we leave now?" "Am I holding you up?" asked Charles. "Is there some place you need to be? Is the local tobacconist having a 1-hour sale on cigarettes?"